The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. It's part four of our coverage of the 67th session of the UN Commission on Narcotic Drugs, and on this edition of Century, we're going to focus on the side events. There are dozens of side events that go on during these CND sessions and intersessional meetings. Some great content, a lot of tremendous speeches and powerful presentations. We start today's show with Anna Dovbach, Executive Director of the Eurasian Harm Reduction Association, speaking March 18th at a side event entitled Addressing Human Rights Challenges Related to Drug Use in Humanitarian and Other Crisis Settings.
I'm so happy to be with you here, and I need to first start with the solidarity with people in Ukraine who are every day dying because of Russian missile attacks and Russian aggression against the country. And it's really horrible in the middle of Europe to have this war. And actually, as any war, it's bring much more vulnerability to all the society, but to marginalized group and to people who use drugs, to people living with HIV, to sex workers, LGBT population, it's bring much more problems and stigma, because we all know that society is not ready to accept this population. So it's one of the challenges in the any curfew, in the any crisis, which also happened in the moment when everybody running from the attacks, everybody running from occupation. But in our case, with the Russian Federation occupying part of the Ukrainian territory, important part is that Ukrainian drug policy and Russian drug policy are very, very different, specifically in access and attitude to opioid agonist treatment and harm reduction. So all occupied territories, people who are living there and using drugs, they are on the threat of interruption of opioid, not on the threat, but the opioid agonist treatment interrupted almost immediately. Only some heroic doctors were providing opioid substitution treatment, for example, in Kherson area till the summer, from February to summer. But that's just exceptions. The rule is that on Russian territories, occupied by Russia territories, the harm reduction is not possible, and even more stigmatizing and more crimes conducted against the people who use drugs. And we have some cases, but that's also need to be documented properly, and we will need to have time and secure safety of people to document these violations of the human rights. Of course, all people and people who use drugs and their families lacking basic resources, places to stay, food, and important part is the trauma and gender-based violence. So that's vulnerabilities with occurs with the war. And speaking about the challenges, I need to say that Ukrainian state, Ukrainian Center for Public Health, was very flexible and very open to the challenges, and they made important decisions on take-home opioid substitution treatment for 30 days, for example. They make the flexible services in the places where people were moving to in the western part of Ukraine. They made all possible together with the international partners, and we are thankful to UN system, to Global Fund to fight HIV, AIDS and malaria, for the emergent procurement of RT drugs and opioid substitution treatment drugs to feed this need in the country. But in the same time, European countries, and we are, again, I need to thank all the European countries for having our refugees and open, lower the barriers to opioid substitution treatment, for example. But these barriers are still very high, and the challenges with access to opioid substitution treatment, to harm reduction in the neighboring countries, is one of the important challenges. So what harm reduction look like in the emerging settings? It is shelter. And you could imagine the harm reduction service delivering the needles exchange, but this organization needs to transform to the shelter in a couple of hours. And we know examples from Poltava region where the harm reduction organization Svetlana Dia opened 5 shelters in a couple of hours because people from Kharkiv region were running to them. And it's thousands of people with their families and kids and mothers and everybody. So you need to feed them, you need to give the food, you need to give the floor to live. To accommodate, and it's not obviously okay to put people who use drugs. They are not very easy to be accommodated in the general shelters. That's why LGBT community organized shelters for them, and people who use drugs also needed to have specific facilities. You need to bring clothes, and what also we need to do, and that was the role of regional organizations, to bring information about available services everywhere where people are running. So they are in stress, they need to know where to find health facilities, where to find food, where to find the basic humanitarian support. And that was important. In the second day of invasion, we had the full European system, Europe and neighbor, all the countries people running to the system where to find from psychological support to the food, to documents, to everything. So that was important sign of solidarity of the whole European harm reductionists, not only with the resources, with money, but also with open hands to support those who are running from the war. So that's actually, for me, an important part in this session is to be, it's hard to be prepared to this, to the war. It's really almost impossible. But that, for me, the key answer, what we need to do, it's to be prepared to be flexible, to open the facilities, to open, to not to be stick to the job description and to not to be stick to the very strong protocols developed in the peacetime. So this flexibility, for me, the answer, and it's flexibility of harm reductionists, it's flexibility of health facilities, and it's openness of the state authorities to respond to the pain. Thank you.
That was Anna Dovbak, Executive Director of the Eurasian Harm Reduction Association, speaking at CND 67 on March 18th at a side event entitled Addressing Human Rights Challenges Related to Drug Use in Humanitarian and Other Crisis Settings. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. This is part 4 of our coverage of the 67th session of the UN's Commission on Narcotic Drugs. On March 19th, there was a side event entitled From Synthetic Drug Threats to Synthetic Drug Realities, Examining the Role of Global Drug Policies and Charting a Way Forward. We're going to hear from a couple of the panelists. First, here's Andrei Selinsky, Contract Manager and Executive Administrator with the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs.
My name's Andrei Selinsky. I work for the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs and was previously a member of that organization. I'm here to speak on behalf of Canadians who use drugs and folks who use drugs around the world, and to make sure that some of their priorities are discussed and to advocate for what I feel and what many folks feel is needed. Situations that my colleagues before me just discussed with regard to the situation in the United States it's very similar to Canada. We have 21 to 22 Canadians dying every day from preventable overdose deaths, and we and there have been efforts made in Canada to do programs such as Safe Supply, to implement harm reduction services, needle exchanges. And Canada is on the one hand seen as a leader in the world when it comes to many of these programs. But on the other hand, the unfortunate reality is that these programs are put out as pilot projects and are rolled out in a very incremental manner. Like, for example, Safe Supply, while it's a tool that can be very helpful, is something that with synthetic drugs and the increased prevalence of xylazine and benzodiazepines, and fentanyl analogs in the drug supply, it's increasingly difficult for, you know, drugs which are the current drugs that are provided a safe for safe supply are primarily morphine and dilaudid or hydromorphone, and it simply, for most drug users, that's not going to address the benzodiazepines in the drug supply or the xylazine in the drug supply, and it's not going to address the tolerance that's created from fentanyl use. It's unfortunately just a little too late. And the other issue is that these programs are presently only have being rolled out in major cities across Canada, and are actually in danger of losing funding. And this speaks to my second point. There's also been a backlash to politically to a lot of to safe supply in Canada, and we're grappling with, you know, division not only within the harm reduction community at times, but throughout the country, and a lot of safe supply programs, especially in rural areas, in Ontario where I live, have closed down. The ones in Toronto are in jeopardy of losing funding or having limited funding and have high staff turnover because of the complexities of addressing these issues. And I think, as was brought up previously, it's really important. Education has to be front and center for this. What a safe supply, making people safe has to be the message that we put forward when it comes to addressing drug toxicity. In other areas, harm reduction practices such as like seat belts and quality control measures that ensure that our food is safe are the status quo. But when it comes to drugs, the drug supply, drug users have to rely on a precarious supply and have to fight tooth and nail to just try to even get on it a safe supply program. And the methadone program, it can be very difficult. While methadone is available throughout Canada, in most regions of Canada, there's weekly doctor visits, urine drug screening, all kinds of complications that come along with that. And I think we have to realize that there's not a one-size-fits-all solution to this program. It needs to be a multi-pronged approach that includes scaled-up access to syringe access programs, scaled-up access to safe supply, public education on a larger scale to alert people to the fact that scheduling precursors, scheduling all these substances is just going to feed into my colleague prior who spoke before was talking about. It's just going to lead to more dangerous drugs, more synthetics, new novel synthetics that are created in pharmaceutical labs, as well as drugs that maybe haven't been around for years or used for years, such as barbiturates, or who knows what. The drug supply has gotten worse and worse and more dangerous as the years have passed, and as we're trying to play catch up with an incremental approach, it's just not good enough. So what I really want to emphasize is the importance of creating safety for people who use drugs, because not only do drug users benefit, but society benefits as a whole by reduced expenditures on healthcare, reduced rates of property crime, a healthier population, increased productivity. It's a win-win situation for everybody to wholeheartedly invest in a safe drug supply. And efforts to do so, I think, it should include medicalized models, but where those have been difficult to scale up, I think we have to also look at DULF, the Drug User Liberation Front in Canada, who attempted to provide safe tested drugs to folks in Vancouver, and get various models to get people to keep people safe.
That was Andre Selinsky with the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs, speaking at a side event at CND67 entitled From Synthetic Drug Threats to Synthetic Drug Realities, examining the role of global drug policies and charting a way forward. Another speaker on that panel was Steve Rolls, Senior Policy Analyst at Transform Drug Policy Foundation.
Yeah, I wanted to just speak briefly about the sort of UK and European experience and try and position that within some of the debates that have been happening this week and last week at the high-level segment, where obviously synthetic opioids were quite a high-profile issue. The situation in Europe is really quite different to North America with regards to synthetic opioids. Most of the heroin in North America came from Mexico to the south, whereas in the UK and Europe, 95% of it has historically come from Afghanistan. And as I'm sure many of you know, the Taliban in 2022 imposed a ban on poppy cultivation, which was shockingly effective. Poppy cultivation fell by almost 95%. And heroin production essentially stopped in Afghanistan. Now, there were significant stockpiles from previous bumper harvests, which have filled the gap in opium and heroin production supplying Europe. But it appears that the constriction on heroin supply to Europe is real, and it may be, to some extent, permanent or long enough to get beyond the stockpile bridge to the point where heroin supply to Europe contracts significantly. And the obvious risk there is that demand for the effects of opioids doesn't disappear. It will just be met by other sources. In this case, substitution with other drugs, including significantly synthetic opioids, but also probably synthetic benzodiazepines and possibly other drugs as well. Another difference in the dynamic between North America and Europe is that fentanyl hasn't really been as anything like a significant part of the illicit opioid market. There has been fentanyl, and there have been fentanyl-related deaths, but it seems like, for reasons I don't really understand, rather than fentanyl, we seem to be having a market dominated by nitazenes, which is another group of synthetic opioids. I'm sorry if anyone's already spoken about this. It's another group of synthetic opioids, quite similar in many respects to fentanyls, in that they are there's a whole family of different analogs. I think 17 have been identified by the European Monitoring Center already. They are between 50 and 1,000 times stronger than morphine. So we're dealing with a similar phenomenon. We are very much at the beginning of this journey within Europe. So in the UK at the moment, there are about 2 deaths a week related to nitazenes. That number may actually be higher, but they're not being detected because forensics are not testing for nitazenes everywhere. But those numbers are rising. There was a police seizure just last November where 150,000 nitazene pills were seized. And I think that shows the scale and potential industrialization of this process. And there is a real fear. I'm very opposed to scaremongering and fearmongering within drug policy, which has been a rather unfortunate element of drug war narratives. But there is a real fear, and I am genuinely afraid, that we are at the, if you look at those horrifying graphs of drug-related deaths in North America, we are at the base of that now, and we could be about to plunge headlong into this catastrophic overdose crisis that has blighted North America over the last 5, 6, 7 years. Our view, Transforms You, my organization, our view is that we need an emergency public health response across Europe. And you'll forgive me for not talking about other regions, which I have less expertise and understanding of. I think this could easily be a major issue in Africa as well, for example. But certainly in Europe, we need an emergency public health response drawing on lessons from North America. We know what works in terms of emergency harm reduction responses. So I'm talking about things like drug checking services, low threshold access drug checking services, supervised consumption spaces that we've seen across countries across the world. There's more than 200 of these now. They're a very well-evidenced intervention. Innovative prescribing practices, sometimes referred to as safer supply, that have been pioneered in Canada. So making things like injectable heroin available on prescription, hydromorphone pills, other forms of opioids, and also stimulants as well, but just focusing on opioids for now. And to underpin all of that, a different approach to law enforcement based on ending the criminalization of people who use drugs to reduce stigma and increase, enable the implementation of those services. And I think what was striking to me about the debates I've witnessed over the last week or so, particularly last week with Secretary Blinken, who is here speaking, Gadia Wally, the executive director of UNODC, was there was a lot of good intention around public health interventions and harm reduction, although Gadia Wally, for some reason, doesn't seem able to say the words harm reduction. Blinken certainly did, and that was very welcome. And then the resolution that's being negotiated this week, I think it's L5, is it? On harm reduction. A lot of this is really welcome, and it shows a sea change in attitudes to this place 5 or 10 years ago when harm reduction was, the words were barely ever muttered at all. It's now being it's being pushed in resolutions, and the US talking about it, and basically everybody's talking about it. The problem for me is this disjuncture with the pragmatism of harm reduction and the public health response and the sort of old school drug war dogma of the enforcement response. So it seems like every time that one of these major figures feels that they want to talk about harm reduction, they also say, and now we're going to have zero tolerance and crack down on supply, and we're going to arrest dealers, and we're going to interrupt, and a load of nonsense about precursors and all of this stuff. Even though the evidence for that is just not there. And it's not just that there's no evidence for supply-side interventions when it comes to synthetic opioids. The evidence all reasonably suggests, objectively suggests, that if you enforce against these synthetic opioids, you actually make the problem worse. You create economic incentives for organized crime groups, transnational organized crime groups, to move towards more potent, dangerous, but more easily produce and traffic products because it works in their economic interest. Why would you bring 50 kilos of heroin across the border when you can bring a matchbox of nitazines or fentanyl? It's just much easier. So I have a deep worry that there is this default towards enforcement responses that don't work, that aren't evidence-based and may actually make things worse. That clouds the discussions, the welcome discussions around harm reduction and an emergency public health response. And I'm particularly worried that those that disjuncture within that conversation that's been happening in this place and in North America is now flowing over into Europe through things like the synthetic opioids task force.
That was Steve Rolls with the Transform Drug Policy Foundation speaking at a side event at CND 67 on March 19th entitled From Synthetic Drug Threats to Synthetic Drug Realities, Examining the Role of Global Drug Policies and Charting a Way Forward. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, and this is part 4 of our coverage of the 67th session of the UN's Commission on Narcotic Drugs. There was a side event March 22nd entitled The Challenges and Opportunities of Opioid Agonist Treatment in Prison Settings. One of the speakers was Jada Girelli, Senior Analyst at Harm Reduction International.
So before we go into OAT, just a brief reminder of why we need harm reduction in prison. And there would be much more to say, but he will cut me off, so I'll be brief. First, the context. We know that drug control drives incarceration and that roughly one-third of people in prison have a history of drug use, and many come into prison with very complex health needs. We also know that people in prison use and will continue to use drugs, and often they have to adopt more harmful drug use patterns than in a community, also because of the setting they find themselves in. Because of these reasons and more, prisons are high-risk environments for the spread of infectious diseases and for overdose. And because of these, virtually all UN agencies, human rights mechanisms, and national guidelines recommend the adoption of harm reduction measures in prison. A key point here already, they recommend it as a public health measure, and that's because prison health is public health, and public health is prison health. Now, there are specific health arguments. Next slide, please. And with reference specifically to OAT, research has shown us that OAT in prison reduces illicit opioid use and risk behaviors, in turn reducing the risk of HIV and viral hepatitis transmission. We also know that enrollment in OAT is linked to a reduction in both overdose mortality and all-cause mortality among people in prison. OAT provision also reduces withdrawal symptoms, which are very often associated with self-harm or even suicide in prison. And finally, pre-release OAT is associated with better retention after release. And this already speaks to the importance of continuity of care between the detention setting and the community. There are also, next slide, please. As Jerome was mentioning before, very clear human rights arguments. The first one, of course, is the fact that people in prison and people who use drugs retain their right to health. Harm reduction has been recognized as an essential component of the right to health for people who use drugs. And with the right to health come very specific standards and principles. Among those, again, the principle of continuity of care, not only between prison and community, but also in between stages of detention. The principle of equivalence of care, so equivalence of standards between prison health and community and public health. And also the standards of availability, accessibility, acceptability, and quality of health-related services. People also have a right not to be ill-treated, and denying OAT in detention has been acknowledged as a potential form of ill-treatment or even torture in some cases. And finally, states have a heightened responsibility to protect the life of people under their direct control, including in situations of detention. Now, that said, what does OAT in prison look like? As the map shows us, the short answer is not great. As of 2023, this is global state of harm reduction data, there were 59 countries where at least one prison was providing OAT to people in detention. Again, we count a country as having OAT when there is at least one prison in the territory providing it. And so the situation is dire, but you already understand from this map is overestimating, overrepresenting the actual availability of the service in detention settings. In terms of how OAT should be delivered in prison, there are a lot of very clear and also very specific standards which can be gathered both from UNODC and WHO guidelines, but also inferred from broader health and human rights standards. Here are some of them. I'm just going to highlight a couple. One is the fact that OAT as all health services should be provided based on voluntary and informed consent. Informed consent means based on comprehensive and evidence-based information in a setting that ensures privacy and confidentiality, based on an individualized assessment of the needs and the situation of the person. That is also true with regards to dosage, for example. OAT shouldn't be, WHO says, with regards to dosage, start low but aim high and aim at maintenance, not just detoxification. And finally, it should be provided by trained healthcare staff, which has no involvement then in the imposition of disciplinary measures. There should be no connection between discipline and health in prison.
That was Giada Girelli with Harm Reduction International speaking at CND 67 on March 22nd at a side event entitled The Challenges and Opportunities of Opioid Agonist Treatment in Prison Settings. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for Community Radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.